Pat Acaldius is being interviewed as a member of the Women's Overseas Service League, San Antonio, Texas Unit at San Antonio on October 21st, 2003. Ruth Stewart is interviewing, assisted by Carol Hapgood. Pat, tell us about your joining the service and what led up to that.
Well, when I was a youngster, I was a Girl Scout. And that was at the age of, let's see, I think 12. It was 1942. And so we became candy stripers and went to work at Memorial Hospital in Lima, Ohio. And as candy stripers, we passed water and we passed juices and we helped put linen oil in the linen closets. And I worked for 2 years as a candy striper, as a volunteer. And our Girl Scout leader left, and we got a new Girl Scout leader who happened to be a dietitian at the hospital. And the dietitian encouraged me to get a work permit because my family was going to move out to a farm, and I didn't want to move to the farm. I wanted to finish high school in Lima. And so I went, got a work permit. I was 14 years old, but during the war, World War II that is, you could get a working permit because they were so short as far as the labor force went. And then after I got the working permit, I went to work in the kitchen at the hospital. And I worked after school and on Saturdays and Sundays. And first I did such things as doing dishes, pots and pans, working on the tray assembly line. And then after a few years, I started to relieve for the cook and relieve for the baker. And then when I was a senior in high school, I decided that I wanted to go to college. And I was interested in going to pre-med, so I applied to Miami University for pre-med. But after I started, my family really didn't have the funds. And I did stay, and I paid my grandparents to stay with them so that I could continue to go to school, you know, in Lima. And I did graduate from Lima South High School.
At Ohio?
Ohio, right. And I applied for Miami, and I was accepted. And I, like I said, started in the College of Arts and Science because I was really interested in pre-med, but I knew that I probably wouldn't have the money to be able to continue, so I picked up all of the subjects that I needed as electives for dietetics. So I was in the College of Arts and Science instead of in the College of Home Ec, with my electives being nutrition and institutional management and things like that. When I was then going home in the summers, I started the first three summers I relieved for the dietitian while I was in college. Instead, I slowly worked up the ladder and was relieving for the dietitian then when I was in school. And the third year, they fired both dietitians, and I was there by myself. And my poor sister, who's 18 months younger than I was a student nurse at the time and assigned in the kitchen. It was a very difficult summer for her. I think they used the student nurses, you know, at that point in time, which was one of the reasons I decided I didn't want to be a nurse. Back when I was a Girl Scout, I thought this is not for me because the student nurses were doing pretty much what the nurse's aides do now, along with some nursing care. So I applied and was selected and went to Oxford, Ohio, Miami University, which was founded in 1809. It's a beautiful school. It's in the Williamsburg style architecture, and they've kept the school conforming that to that style. So the campus is a beautiful campus. And when I was a junior, we had a letter from an Army dietitian, Nancy Houston, who indicated that the Army had an internship available. And I'd been working as a waitress for my meals, and I'd been working in the library at night for my tuition, and I was cleaning houses on weekends for spending money. And so that sounded like a pretty good deal, that if you came in, you were commissioned as a second lieutenant. So I applied and was accepted to the Army internship program. My first big mistake was that basic was to be at Fort Sam Houston, and so I bought a ticket for Houston, Texas on the train. When I got to St. Louis to change trains, I was talking to some young man at the counter, and he said, "You're going where?" And I said, "I'm going to Houston, Texas." And he said, "Fort Sam Houston is not in Houston, Texas, it's in San Antonio." And so they very nicely changed my ticket and switched my luggage to San Antonio. So I arrived in San Antonio for basic. And I had applied for the dietetic internship at Walter Reed. I knew that I could never afford to do the medical internship. And they didn't have the programs then that they have now for physicians.
So you entered the Army Specialist Corps?
Right.
At what year was that?
That was in 1948. Right. And I graduated from high school in 1948. And that summer I did not work in the hospital. The last summer I camp counseled in Wisconsin, Camp Agawak, and taught camp craft and swimming and canoeing.
So tell us about your early days then as an intern in the dietetic program.
Well, here again, they were very short. They were short of dietitians, and so there were a number of involuntary recalls from the Korean conflict that were being called back on active duty. And so I started my internship at Walter Reed, and I'm afraid that I spent as much time in staff relief just about as I did in the intern training program, except for all the medical lectures. And I did get to do the medical lectures. But I spent a lot of time in the office of the chief working on job descriptions and things like that. However, it was a year long, and it was a good learning experience. There were 12 of us, and we still, most of us, correspond. There are three now living here in San Antonio that were in my basic, but they were Brook interns. And this is our 50th year, as a matter of fact. The American Dietetic Association is meeting here next week, and the 50-year members of the American Dietetic Association are being honored. And registration is $250, and it's free for us. So we're going to have sort of a meeting of everybody that was in both of our internship classes while we're here, because mm-hmm. it's 50 years for all of us.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened?
After I finished my dietetic internship, I went to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, which had just reopened because of the Korean conflict, and they were short, you know, on bases and posts, and we were in the old cantonment-type hospital. We had coal-burning ranges in the dining hall. They had to lay the fires. If you got a downdraft, the soot came out all over everything, including the frosting on the cake, which occasionally we scraped off, sprinkled shave chocolate on it. The place was staffed by Ozark people, that basically Ozark mountaineers, that really hadn't had any experience because the post had closed after World War II. And so that was a real learning experience. It was cold. We wore our overcoats in the office, had snow drifts on our desks. The pipes would freeze. There were two of us there. We had 1,400 patients. And that was my first assignment. And then from there, I was transferred to Okinawa. And I was chief of Ward Food Service in Okinawa. And while I was there, we built the new hospital, which was an 8-story building. It was supposed to be an 18-month tour. And so I shipped my car, my automobile home. However, I got extended until we moved into the new hospital. But while I was there, they hadn't had a typhoon in years. And we had a typhoon that hit every other weekend for, we had 6 typhoons in 1 year. And they would admit all of the pregnant women into the hospital, and all of the married personnel, hospital personnel, were permitted to stay at home. And so our hospital was in Quonset Huts, and we moved the first time into the new field house that they had just finished with hardwood floors, and they had the glass skylights in the top. Well, we went into the place with field ranges because, of course, the power went out. We had babies in sea ration cartons. The nurses forgot the urinals. We used corned beef cans for urinals, you know, the long corned beef cans. It was a very improvised, and in that particular time, we had taken sea rations with us because we were not totally prepared to do that and to move. Well, what happened first was that the water got under the beautiful parquet floor, and it started to warp, and it actually warped waist high. Then the skylight started coming down, and so we put the patients under the bleachers and stretched tarps over them. And that was the last time we moved into the field house, but every time we moved into something, there were all sorts of new and unusual situations. So by the time we moved the third time, we were pretty well organized, and we didn't begin to have the problems we had before. At one time, I was dating a Marine, and luckily the Marine barracks were right behind. We moved into the dispensary the second time, which was at the Marine base. And we didn't have water. The water tanks weren't delivered by the engineers. And I knew that they were ready to go out in the field, and so the sergeant and I got down on the ground and worked our way over to the Marine barracks. And they hauled some water trailers over, so we had water for the hospital. That was
improvising again.
And then we moved into the new facility right before I left. And of course, that was the first elevator on the island, and the Okinawans used to stick the food carts onto the elevator, and they'd run like crazy up. They'd grab the food cart off on the 6th and 7th floors. And then after they got used to the elevators, they just wanted to ride up and down all day in the elevators. And again, we put in a centralized tray service system, so they were calling from English menus and Japanese to assemble the carts in the new hospital.
Now, this was a period between wars, right?
This was 56 to 58, 1956 to 58. I left Fort Leonard Wood in 1956.
And what kind of patients did you take care of there at that hospital?
That was Army, Navy, Air Force. It was basically, it was an Army hospital, but we supported VOD. And we had like 16 to 18 broken jaws, because the Navy and the Marines didn't get along too well. And we had all kind of fights. The men that were over there, the Marines could not have dependents. And so they all had motor scooters. So between the fights at the Navy Club and the motor scooters, and at that point in time, they wired their jaws shut, you know, when they were broken. And so we had dental liquid diets. More dental liquids than anything else. Dental liquids and babies.
Those were the major patients that you had.
Right.
Okay. What were some of your most memorable experiences there?
On Okinawa?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my car was sandblasted. I think I had it painted. Well, I had it painted after every typhoon except one, and that one came too fast. So I think my car was painted 5 times. You know, it sat right on the beach, and the sand would just literally take the paint off. One typhoon, the wind instruments blew away at 250 miles an hour, and so they don't know how strong those winds actually were. But it went up toward Japan, then turned around, came back, hit us going the other way. That was the one that we didn't have time to, I didn't have time to get the car painted between. It was the same typhoon.
Yeah. Other experiences?
On Okinawa?
Of course, crawling along
well,
to get your water tanks.
When we had the opening ceremony, the hospital commander was showing his office, and one of the Okinawan women decided to change her baby on his desk. That left an impression, especially on him. It was a challenging experience. Madam Chiang Kai-shek was a patient there twice, and she gave me I don't think it's legal to bring them back, but she gave me a beautiful tortoise shell box that sits on a little tray, and it has a rosebud like on top, a stem. Mm-hmm. And that was right after one of the typhoons, and she wanted egg drop soup, and so at that point in time, our perishables, of course, were all gone. We didn't have any chickens. We had bee rations and canned foods. And so I took some chicken noodle soup and I strained it. And I used powdered eggs. And I made egg drop soup. And she thought it was very, very good and wanted to know how I made egg drop soup. And I said, chef's secret. So I never did admit as to how I made egg drop soup.
Did
and of
you?
Course, we went on, you know, the beach lots of times. I sent shells back to my father. seashells.
Mm-hmm.
I sent the other kind of shells from World War II back as candle holders, candelabra, and things like that.
So two types of shells.
Yeah, two types.
Was beachcombing your major recreation there, or did you have other forms?
Well, there were a lot of Marines. And everybody, you know, was in the same situation, so everyone went to the clubs, and we had a really good time. But we also did spend a lot of time on the beach.
Were you able to travel off the island?
Yes. We could take any of the embassy, you know, trips. And I went to Japan to visit several times. I went to Taipei, I went to the Philippines, I went to India. That's about it.
Quite a lot of travel. What about
the Navy would toot us around the island just on a ship. The water was so blue, there's a trench that I don't remember how many miles deep it is, but the water is so blue that it looks like you should be able to pick up a cup of it and look in it and it should still be blue. It's beautiful, beautiful place. Tropical. Your shoes would mold.
Were there other experiences that you had that were difficult for your living experience?
No, you learned to chew without bringing your teeth together because the sand would blow in. It was tropical construction, our houses. And actually, we were billeted at the new hospital, which was an engineer base. We were billeted at the new hospital shortly after I arrived, we were in sponsored huts at Camp Fuey. But when we built it in the new hospital, we had actual houses. So we had, each person had their own room, and you shared a bath, and we had a kitchen and a living room and a utility room. And, of course, maids. We didn't have to do our washing or ironing or cleaning or any of those good things.
But in your actual dietetics work, you had to do a lot of improvising still?
Yes, yes. Subsistence was sporadic, but especially after the typhoons, because we would just lose refrigeration and they didn't have the generator support they needed. They after the first two or three, you know, they started to get generators in country, but it was a lot.
Did you feel satisfied with that you were able to maintain the adequate nutrition for your patients under the circumstances?
Actually, it was adequate. It wasn't most palatable at first. If they would eat it, it would have been adequate. It was difficult with the dental diets because we ended up just about using baby food, whereas in the hospital we would puree regular foods, which are much more tasty and have some flavor. And we did have, you know, like I said before, a number of dental patients. Mm-hmm. So they're the ones that probably it was the most unpalatable. But everybody else we used, after our initial experience of C rations, we cooked B rations and we kept provisions on hand. Like to make chicken salad and tuna salad out of, you know, canned meats and things like that.
Did you receive medals or citations during your service?
My entire service?
Mm-hmm.
I have the Army Commendation Medal with three oak leaf clusters. I have the Meritorious Service Medal. I have the Bronze Star. And I have the Legion of Merit with two or three clusters. And then the various service ribbons, you know, campaign ribbons.
How did you get these?
What?
I guess.
Basically, hard work. I got the Army Commendation Medal on Okinawa.
While you were in Okinawa, how did you stay in touch with your family and friends at home?
The only way you could, you wrote letters. Basically, I don't remember anybody that ever made a telephone call back to the States. Except in emergency.
Do you remember, well, you've described some, but are there other humorous events or unusual events that occurred while you were in Okinawa?
Oh, many, but Okinawa was just one tour. I was invited to attend an Okinawan birthday. Koyu was my interpreter, and his grandfather's birthday. They invited me to come to his grandfather's birthday party, and they seated me at the right hand of the grandfather, and he was served first, and then I was always offered to be served next, and that was the first time I was ever served dog, which I ate. And I also had never had goat before. It was yagi goat. And whenever all of the virgins always had to have the same time off because they have turtle-type tombs on Okinawa. And when their ancestors die, they tie their hands to their wrists and they sit cross-legged inside of these tombs. And then they have these big burial bases. And at a certain time of the moon, the virgins in the family have to scrape their ancestors' bones into these vases. And so, at least they all claim to be virgins. When this time of the moon came and we had a very difficult time in food service, at that point in time we had ward kitchens, which meant that we prepared the eggs and things like that actually on the wards. It was more difficult then, actually, than when we had tray service in the new hospital. Mm-hmm. But that was the only place I've ever been where you had to let all the virgins off at a certain time of the moon. And from, let's see, from Okinawa, I went to Walter Reed.
To where?
Walter Reed, back to Walter Reed. Not at my request, but I was sent back to Walter Reed as project officer for putting in a centralized service of trade, a centralized trade service system there, which we had put into the new hospital on Okinawa, which meant that closing all of the ward kitchens where they had done all of the preparation, you were able to cook the patient's eggs to order, and everyone knew what, you know, how the patients wanted their eggs, and it all arrived hot. So we went to the centralized service, tray service type carts, where everything is done on the conveyor belt in the kitchen and then sent out to the wards. And there's a refrigerated side and a heated side. So I was lucky enough to be assigned to do the floor plans for changing and renovating the kitchen, and for establishing the training and what have you to put centralized tray service into Walter Reed. So I got to work like I had on Okinawa, 7 days a week, 6 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock at night.
What year was that?
That was 1958. To 1960, and in 1960 I was sent, it was 1959, and I was sent then to, after we had implemented centralized trade service, I was sent to the healthcare administration course here in San Antonio at Medical Field Service School, and it affiliates with Baylor University, and I received my master's in healthcare administration. I had to have a waiver because I think I had 8 years of service. And I was a captain when I went. And from after completing that course, I was sent to Letterman for the residency in healthcare administration. So I spent then 1 year at Letterman. And I was sent from Letterman, I went to Governor's Island, which was a beautiful assignment. And our quarters looked out over the lower tip of Manhattan. The dining room looked out at the Statue of Liberty, and you got to see all of the fireboats going out every time a new ship came in. Or the only thing is that the sergeant and I were the only two military, and we lived on the island, and when the island was fogged in, the sergeant and I fixed breakfast for the hospital and all the troops assigned to the hospital.
What an experience.
It was so cold that the icicles came out at right angles from the seawall in the winter. It was colder than Alaska because you weren't dressed or prepared or equipped for it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the ice would come over the seawall and freeze, and we couldn't deliver to the back at all because it would be frozen in a mound, and deliveries would have to come in the front door of the hospital. But I wasn't there very long because my mother came to visit, and the chief of our dietitian section happened to be there at the same time my mom was, And Mother didn't know that she was chief dietitian section, and so she asked my mother, Colonel Davis asked my mother how I was enjoying my assignment, and she said, well, she's bored with her assignment, but she loves New York. And I was only there 11 months. And then I was moved to Brook Army Medical Center in Fort Sam Houston, Texas, because they were going to renovate the kitchen. And so I got to do the floor plans. And we had, at that time, we had 5 different dining halls at Brook. And we fixed the food at the main kitchen and then hauled the food to Beach, which was the largest building, and then we fixed the diet food at the main kitchen, we fixed the regular food in the psychiatric kitchen, and then hauled it all to Beach, which was the biggest part of the hospital, was at Beach, during the renovation, and we had an improvised assembly line. And I just finished that assignment, and we had everything functioning, and so I was on leave celebrating the fact it was over with, and I got a telephone call saying, you have to be ready in 30 days to go to Vietnam, which was rather difficult for me because I had my mother with me, I had my brother. My mother and brother had gone with me ever since my father had passed away in 1959. They had traveled with me. So I had 30 days to sell my house in San Antonio, buy a house in Ohio, which was where my sister lived, get my things packed, and get myself to Vietnam.
And what stage of the Vietnam War was this?
This was 1966, 1967. I was the first dietitian assigned in Vietnam. When I went there, I was covering 8 hospitals. When I left, I was covering 18. But I spent a great deal of time working with the First Logistical Command, because until they can get organized and get the food coming in country, I couldn't do menus like for the hospital. It was worthless because our food delivery was so erratic and sporadic. And some places were on A rations, some places were on B rations, some places were on C rations. And so a great deal of my time was spent working with logistics, and I wrote the menu for the command from Vietnam, which is the first time that that's ever been done. It has always come out of quartermaster. But General Eifler was commanded the First Logistical Command, and at that point in time, the Medical Brigade came under the Logistical Command, not under the use of the surgeon. And so with his support and backing, I told him that until we came up with a cyclic menu so that they could get some stockage factors, I couldn't do what I needed to do in the hospitals.
After he
understood that this meant the menu would repeat every 4 weeks, this would give them an experience factor in what items to order and how much they needed to order. And so I sold him on cycle menus. And so he told the quartermaster center basically that we would have a cycle menu in Vietnam. And so what it ended up was that I wrote the menu for A rations, and then I wrote a B ration menu supplement of A rations, and then I wrote a B ration menu, and then the C rations. And then they sent a team from Chicago over to work on the menu there in Vietnam. But he was most supportive. And also, I could get any equipment. The equipment was just stacked and stacked in the warehouses. And none of the troop messes, for example, had electricity. They didn't have generators. Well, we had generators in the hospitals because we had x-ray, and we had to have generators. So when we first started with some of the hospitals had electricity when I went there. But when they would come in country, they would not have electricity. But we had this nice little thing where in x-ray, they take a tin can and they put stones in a tin can. And in the kitchen, they'd have a tin can with stones in it, and they have a long rope in between. And if they wanted to, if they were using the French fry, I could get French fryers. If they were using the French fry machine and x-ray needed an x-ray, they'd just pull on the can, they'd cut off the French fry machine and then take x-rays. So we could do things like that, you know, at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And I arrived there in May, and the Army had taken over logistics from the Navy in April. And we had, in Saigon, we had lobster and frozen raspberries and all sorts of great things, but we didn't have any food. And we had all kind of silver for the Navy messes, but we didn't have any stainless steel knives and forks and spoons, you know, things like that.
What was your life like there?
Well, when I was first assigned there, I was assigned there to establish a system for hospital food service in country. And they assigned me to the third field, and I was assigned under the chief nurse, which didn't bother me, but I was selected for promotion to lieutenant colonel, and she wasn't, so it bothered her. So anyway, and I was also the only dietitian, so I was getting calls from all of the hospitals and the hospital commanders, and they were all having problems. And so the hospital commander at the Third Field Hospital felt that I belonged at the 68th Medical Group, and so he called then Colonel Pixley and said, you know, I think the Pat should be transferred and that she belongs with group, not at the Third Hospital. So I was transferred to the 68th Medical Group, and then the 46th and 55th Medical Groups were calling Colonel Pixley and saying, well, we want her to come and work with the support centers. And so Colonel Pixley then went to the 44th Medical Brigade Commander and said, I think Pat should be assigned to the 44th Medical Brigade, not the 68th Medical Group, because she's spending a lot of time with the other two medical groups. So then I was assigned with the 44th Medical Brigade. Well, the 44th Medical Brigade, the men lived in the headquarters building. That was their billets as well as their building. So they, duty was, you know, pretty casual. They weren't always full uniform. And so they decided that they had this little place at First Log Headquarters. And it was on top of the swimming pool, but brigade was under First Log Command, you know, at that point in time. And so this was sort of the nerve center for the 44th Medical Brigade and the communication and liaison between the commanding general, 44th Medical Brigade and the commanding general at First Log Command. The only problem was it was located on top of the swimming pool. The office was on top of the swimming pool that had been floored over. It was a big old Chinese mansion in the state, and the general was in the mansion and his staff, and then there were temporary buildings all the way around. And I was the only female, and the general had the only private John, so I got to know the general. But he was an outstanding man. They couldn't have had a better man there, I don't think, at that point in time. And there was a Colonel Oba that was subsistence officer. And so whenever any of the hospitals weren't getting anything, they would let me know, and then Colonel Oba would know where the inventories, you know, weren't being kept up and some of the problems with subsistence out in the different support commands. And it really did work very well. And we were responsible for feeding not only our American soldiers, but we also provided the subsistence for the Australians and the Koreans. And then what happened was that the Vietnamese soldiers were only getting two meals a day. And so they wanted to supplement the Vietnamese ration with B rations. The part of it was the Americans' fault. We had cost of living, cola, messes, and so we were buying all of the produce locally available, and the shrimp and fruit and things like that, and sending the prices up to where the Vietnamese couldn't afford, to buy their own food. And so I spent a week over in the quartermaster in the Vietnamese army, and I took all of the food that came in, plus then kept track of the number of people that they fed, and tried to figure out what some of it was, like long beans. Compare nutritionally wise, I think that they were about the same as green beans. But I kept a record of all of that, and then I sent it back to the metabolic, all the information for a week, back to the metabolic lab, and they calculated basically their intake. The Vietnamese soldier, the average height is about 5'2" on the Vietnamese soldier, and the Vietnamese female is 4'8". So their caloric requirements, weren't the same as ours, but their intake was totally inadequate. They had the two meals a day, and breakfast was soup, and then the evening meal was soup and rice, and any meat basically or vegetables went into the soup. And they were given piastres to buy the soup and the meat. Then they were issued oil, sugar, tea, and rice. Those were issue items. The rest they were on their own to get what they could. But like I said, we had sent the price of produce with our cola messes literally out of sight. Mm-hmm. And so we did get then authority to supplement the Vietnamese rations with our B rations. And then all of the baby food that was on hand was becoming outdated. That's from the dependents being in Vietnam. So I had it issued out to the hospitals, and we in turn sort of sub-issued it out to the orphanages. So that, because it was still good, it had reached its expiration date, and we couldn't use it, but the orphanages. So they just issued it all out to the hospital. And the hospitals, via the dust off and what have you, managed to get it out to all the medical groups and managed to get it out to the orphanages. So that worked quite well.
You were very busy in your professional life. What did you do in your personal life?
Well, at first we were pretty much restricted to the compound because we were at Tan Son Nhut, which is where the air base is, right outside of, adjacent to Saigon. We were, Tan Son Nhut and the Cholon district sort of run right into each other. And so you socialized with the people that were in that area. We had a kitchen. We were in the chief nurse and I shared a very small apartment. And then one of the general officers got a villa for us. And so we were given a villa. And we had a very nice French villa with three bedrooms, kitchen, bath. Of course, the bath, we had Saigon water. And the maids would run the buckets of water the day before so mud had settled to the bottom, you know. And we had to use potable water. But in the potable water, you know, you'd see these little tadpoles swimming. You sort of strained them out and brushed your teeth.
So how long did you serve in the military overall?
29 years and 6 months.
And where were you when you left the military?
Well, let's see. I went from Vietnam. I was chief at Fitzsimmons from Denver, and then I went from Denver to to Fort Dix, New Jersey, and then I was assigned as chief at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. And then while I was chief at Walter Reed Army Medical Center, I'd just been there a short time, and the chief dietitian section had a heart attack, and I was supposed to be project officer for building the new food service at the new Walter Reed. But when she had a heart attack, then the chief dietitian section is a statutory position. It's established by Congress, and it's a 4-year tour. And they were having a lot of racial problems, and so I was assigned to Walter Reed. They interviewed you, and I said, please, any place except Walter Reed. I've already had, you know, my 3 tours there. But anyway, I was assigned to Walter Reed. And then General Bernstein refused to give me up, but you can't really refuse the Surgeon General for very long. So for about 6 months, I was double-hatted, being chief of Walter Reed because of the racial problems and putting a lid on that, plus being chief of dietitian section. And either one is one of the good 7-day-a-week, you know, jobs. And so finally, I got adequate staff in at Walter Reed that could handle the situation there. And then, unfortunately, I had bought in Maryland because I was assigned to Walter Reed and ended up in the Pentagon. So I was commuting every day. And like I said, the chief dietitian section, you made all the dietitian assignments, plus you approved all the floor plans and layouts, plus you were responsible for all the regulations. And the Army Surgeon General is the executive agent for nutrition for the Department of Defense, and so you were his representative on the menu boards and on the Department of Defense activities. You weren't his representative, and that was more than a full-time job.
So then when did you actually leave the Army?
I left. Well, that was a 4-year statutory tour. So at the end of the 4 years, I wanted to get out, but I got talked into taking the job of Chief AMSC Division at Health Services Command. The job in the Surgeon General's office is basically policy, procedure, assignments, personnel, layout, equipment. The Chief AMSC Division at Health Services Command, at that point in time, the Chief Dietitian Section was responsible for the operation of all of the facilities in the continental United States, Panama, Hawaii, and Alaska. And we took over Panama while I was chief at Health Services Command. Health Services Command is located right adjacent to the academy at Fort Sam Houston. So that's where I spent my last 4 years. And there you physically covered. When I was in the Surgeon General's office, I covered all the overseas hospitals. When I was at Health Services Command, I covered all the hospitals in continental United States, Alaska, Panama, and Hawaii.
So you sort of reached across the world.
I got there one way or another.
So then your retirement then was from
Health Services Command
to stay in San Antonio,
right,
following that.
Right.
And that leads you to now living here at the Army Residence Center. But there were several years in between that you lived in your own home.
Right. Well, I lived in Windcrest, and then I couldn't keep up with the grounds and what have you, and so I moved into a house in Royal Ridge, which was just as much house, but not quite as much grounds.
Mm-hmm.
But then after I retired from the Army, one of the dietitians, Colonel Manny Evans, who's also a resident here now, was working for the state, and she had a friend that needed a dietitian, and she talked me into going to work for him. It was a matter of care nursing home. So I worked there for a short period of time, and then Sister Eleanor Ann Young at an Incarnate Word had been our consultant for our dietetic internship when I was on active duty. I had hired her as consultant. So when they built the new complex at Incarnate Word, the assisted living nursing home and retirement center, she asked me if I'd be willing to set up food service there to meet state standards and requirements before, you know, the nuns had been at St. Joseph's and been like a convent. That was a challenge.
Did you join any veterans organizations after you left the service?
I joined the American Legion, but then I was in the state, Texas State Nutrition Council and the Texas Gerontological Practice Group and the Texas Healthcare Facilities Practice Group, and I held offices in all of those, and then was adjutant for the Legion. And then after I finished Incarnate Word, that's when they were getting ready to open this place. And so Colonel Stubblefield, who was the executive director, knew that I'd been working with nursing homes, and so he asked me if I would set up the health care for state licensure here. But then they had some problems in food service, and I ended up taking the kitchen and the Sky Lounge and the catering, as well as healthcare. And I agreed to do it only until they found someone that would work full time. So when an Army dietitian retired, then I quit. And then I went to work for the state, surveying nursing homes.
Did your experience in the military, those many years, influence your view of war or the military?
Well, you have to remember that I came back from Vietnam and had blood thrown at me. I took a group of second lieutenants up to Colorado State, and we had to go in uniform when we went to meetings. And they had big signs outside when we came outside. Drop taxes, not bombs, peace, all kinds of peace things and what have you. When I was stationed at the Pentagon, I got hit with a bag of pig's blood once. That gave you a very strange feeling, because when I was stationed in Vietnam, I spent our sickest patients went to the third field to be stabilized, to medevac out. And some of them were not combat-type injuries, but they had fulcrum malaria, and they were renal patients. And we had a very strange diet that we came up with that they could tolerate. And but I was there and more than once helped in triage. And after you've cut these young kids, after you've cut the uniforms off of them or wherever you see blood, after you've gone in the back of what some of the surges and fallen over a body bag, not being aware it was right inside the back door, and then you come back and you're treated like you started the war, you are responsible, that gives you a little different feeling. And I think it's just tremendous, the difference that the Americans and their perception now than it was during the Vietnam conflict.
Thank you very much for the interview, Pat.